From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, in for Cynthia Canty. We continue our series of interviews with candidates running for governor. Today, Republican Brian Kelly.
The most logical place to start is with security in our schools.
Consumers Energy is funding two political funds to influence elections.
It's been a striking amount of money. $43 million over the past 4 years.
Sure, yeah, it's the comeback city, but what about the small businesses in Detroit?
So you have all these wonderful programs that's coming and happening in City Detroit, but if no one is getting out to the neighborhoods telling the business owners about it, there's no benefit to it.
And Shakespeare in prison.
I love to perform. It really feels like I'm doing something that's positive and something that does not even remind me of prison.
We'll bring you all those conversations and more. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, in for Cynthia Canty. We begin with another story about dark money in Michigan politics. Reporters and activists have been piecing together what appears to be a couple of political organizations backed by Michigan's big utility companies, targeting politicians that disagree with their goals. Joining us now is Matt Casper. He is research director for the Energy and Policy Institute, a watchdog group tracking big utility companies. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So what are the names of these two political organizations we're talking about?
We're talking about the Citizens for Energizing Michigan's Economy, and we're also talking about Faithful Conservatives for Michigan.
Now, these are both 501c4s. That's supposed to be a designation for a social welfare organization, like a civic group. But Citizens for Energizing Michigan's Economy and Faithful Conservatives are spending a lot of money on political campaigns. So how does that fit into a social welfare organization category?
Well, they're limited. They're supposed to be limited in the amount of money that they spend if they want to keep their 501c4 status. They can only spend about 50% of their revenue on political ads, but they get around that by kind of changing the ads, the radio or the TV ads, by not necessarily endorsing a candidate, but just telling the viewers, you know, call up this legislature and tell them thank you for supporting or voting for this bill.
You, Cranes Detroit, and the Michigan Campaign Finance Network have been looking into the history of these two political organizations. Who's been donating money to these groups?
Consumers Energy has, and it's been a striking amount of money, $43 million over the past 4 years and $20 million just in 2017 alone.
Wow. So what are they doing with that money?
It's really hard to tell. And this is the strange thing. Michigan's for re-energizing the economy, they're not reporting all of that money to the IRS, not even close. We found every year there's a discrepancy between what they report and how much Consumers Energy gives them.
Is that just an oversight?
It's a fine from the IRS to inaccurately report information. So no one has been forthcoming on the inaccuracies.
I bet you there's some amended reports being put together right now. So these Consumers Energy Finance political groups are spending money on ads to promote Representative Brett Roberts and former Representative Kevin Daley. Why do you think Consumers Energy values these two candidates so much that its political organizations are spending a lot of money on those candidates' campaigns?
Well, they want, and this is, you can tell from the money, they want their opponents, Representative Glenn and Barrett, to no longer be in positions in Lansing. Those are legislators that have constantly been trying to enact policies that would open up the market and create competition against consumers.
That's Tom Barrett and Gary Glenn. They've asked for sort of a deregulation and letting other electric companies in. They've also been talking about net metering, which the Public Service Commission just eliminated, and we're not sure what's going to happen next. These are all things that the Consumers Energy and DTE want. So you're saying, because these two politicians go against what the big utility wants, it's supporting opponents hoping that they'll lose in the primary.
That's exactly right. And Representative Glenn is chairman of the House Energy Committee.
So he's got some clout. He makes some decisions. He also called one of the utilities, I think it was Consumers, a terrorist, which a lot of people said was uncalled for and just wrong. although he's refused to apologize, do you think it gets down to something that simple, or is it the larger picture?
You know, I don't really know. I think this is such a heated time in the energy space, you know, not really just in Michigan, but all across the country and even at the federal level.
Well, even given the amount of money that they've already spent on these two opponents, it's something in the area of $160,000 or so. That's not even close to $43 million. What does that say about what's going to happen in the general election?
You know, I think only consumers in DTE are going to increase campaign contributions. Now, there's a limit, but you can see more money flowing to political action campaigns. More of these groups might pop up, 501c4 organizations. They can donate to the state parties. There's just going to be so much more money flowing in ahead of the election.
How typical is it that an investor-owned utility company would target a couple of politicians that disagree with what the utility wants?
It's really strange, you know, particularly targeting two Republicans. I've been following this for a number of years, not just in Michigan, but in other states. And it's pretty striking. We almost did a double take to make sure, is this really what's happening? But it is. It's a pretty odd occurrence.
So Consumers Energy says that this is not ratepayers' money. This is shareholders' money that they're using to do this political action with. The bottom line is, why should people care about this? Why should voters care about something like this?
Consumers Energy's customers should care because this is their utility company. And most of those customers, they're forced to buy the power from consumers. They should have a say in how that utility company behaves. Now, it's not also just the consumers. Consumers Energy investors are also increasingly concerned about the political decisions that their company is making. And they've tried to introduce shareholder resolutions to get more disclosure from the utility company.
And where's that gone?
Well, it almost passed last month. It got 45% support. The New York Common State Retirement Fund, it's the third largest public pension plan in the nation. They've almost been successful in getting that resolution. I have to imagine it will pass next year.
Matt Casper is Research Director for the Energy and Policy Institute, a watchdog group tracking big utility companies' statements about renewable energy. Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Consumers Energy sent us this statement in response to our questions. Quote, as a good corporate citizen, we are engaged in the political process, welcome constructive dialogue, and support pragmatic policies that are focused on safe, reliable, and affordable energy for Michigan, and supports organizations that provide education and advocacy related to such policies. Our contributions to Citizens for Energizing Michigan's economy came from the company in the form of non-customer shareholder dollars, end quote. Also, we tried to speak with one of the state legislators who is a target of Consumers Energy, but he was unable to break away from today's legislative session. And finally, in full disclosure, Consumers Energy is a sponsor of Michigan Radio. There have been more than 100,000 water shutoffs in Detroit since the city launched an aggressive campaign in 2014. That's according to data from Bridge Magazine. The number of shutoffs for non-payment has gone down significantly since 2014, but activists and city officials alike say the number is still too high. Now, as Jake Neer reports, water advocates say they've identified a solution to the problem.
Reverend Rosalind Bouye opens a door at the Brightmoor Connection food pantry where a single pallet of bottled water is stacked in the corner. There's only a few cases left.
So this is where our water station is, and usually the water is up so high, it's up as high. So I have a delivery coming this Wednesday.
Bouye provides water to families who have had their water shut off or who are facing contamination issues. She gets the water from the activist group We the People of Detroit.
As soon as the water comes in, the water's going out. And so it's a hard process to keep up with.
Bouye says demand for the water is highest now after the first of the month when shutoff notices come from the Department of Water and Sewerage. She says the people who come for the water often carry a burden of profound shame, especially parents of small children.
I'll say to them, listen, it's socioeconomics. Just like being hungry is socioeconomics. It doesn't make you a bad person. Doesn't mean you don't love your kids. It doesn't mean that you're not trying. It means that you can't make the ends meet.
This is a massive humanitarian crisis.
That's Emily Cudel, an architecture professor at the University of Detroit Mercy. Cudill also researches and studies water shutoffs for We the People of Detroit. She echoes what the United Nations said in 2014, that the shutoffs in Detroit were contrary to human rights. Since then, DWSD has implemented a program that provides assistance for residents with their water bills and has put thousands of customers on payment plans designed to help people keep their taps on. The city credits that for reducing shutoffs by tens of thousands of households per year since 2014. But Cudill says that's not enough.
It's never going to be enough. It hasn't been enough. And it's failing. It's still failing. 18,000 households being shut off a year is failing.
Cudill says there's a possible solution out there, and it's already in place in Philadelphia. A year ago, that city implemented an affordability program that sets water rates based on household income. It's a tiered system that allows the poorest residents to pay as little as $12 per month to keep their water on. The Tiered Assistance Program, or TAP, is available to people within 150% of the federal poverty level. Deborah McCarty is Philadelphia's water commissioner. She says that plan makes a lot of sense for the city and its residents.
The more folks paying water bills is always better, whether it's a portion or the entire amount, and not driving up the receivables by not paying anything. And we definitely see that allowing folks to stay in their home and have water is better for the city. For sure.
So advocates in Detroit ask, why can't we have that here? Well, it may actually be illegal.
The jury is still out on whether or not that model will work in other places.
That's Detroit Water and Sewerage Department Director Gary Brown.
I know this, it's not going to work in Michigan until there's some legislation that changes the legal framework that utilities have to work under regarding rates.
Brown says Michigan's constitution prohibits utilities like DWSD from implementing an affordability program that sets rates based on income like the TAP program in Philly. He says he wants the state to change that policy to give utilities more options to deal with these problems. But amending the state constitution is a heavy lift. And Brown has other concerns about programs like TAP. Philadelphia officials admit it has cost the city millions of dollars to implement the program and millions more lost in revenue. Those costs are placed on other water customers. Brown says he worries higher water bills for everyone else would especially harm working poor Detroiters. In the meantime, advocates continue to call for an immediate moratorium on shutoffs. I'm Jake Neer.
Up next, we'll take you inside a state prison where the curtain's about to go up on a production of Shakespeare's Macbeth. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Shakespeare in Prison is a program of the Detroit Public Theater, currently in its seventh season. The ensemble is made up of inmates at Women's Huron Valley Correctional Facility in Washtenaw County. It's the only women's prison in the state. Franny Shepherd Bates runs the program, and here's how she describes it.
The goal is not so much to train actors or to put on the highest quality artistic performance as we can, but instead to learn new things about ourselves and new ways of moving through the world in a really positive way, connecting to other people, learning about ourselves and our pasts in order to move forward.
This week, the women at Huron are set to perform Shakespeare's Macbeth in front of fellow inmates and staff. Stateside's Mercedes Mejia went to a full dress rehearsal before opening night, and she has this audio postcard for us.
Circle up, ladies.
This is me getting dressed.
I am transforming myself into a fat person. That right there.
You changed the color?
Yes, I wanted to match with my outfit.
My first name is Keita.
So who are you playing?
I am playing Banquo in Macbeth. I am Macbeth's friend, or so I think.
In the name of truth, are you fantastical, or that indeed which outwardly shows? To my noble partner, you speak of great presence and noble prediction.
When I first go on stage, I'm nervous. But as I go, I feel exhilarated. I feel like I am like the only one out there. And it's amazing.
Which will grow and which will not? Speak then to me, who neither fear nor beg your favors nor your hate. Hail! Hail! Hail!
I've been here since 2007. And This is my first year doing Shakespeare, and I'm really enjoying it. I thought I wasn't going to be able to understand some of the language that was going on, but once we started getting into it, it was amazing. I feel like I'm right at home.
Do you have a parole date?
Yes, I do. 2029 is my official out date, but I'm working on some things, and hopefully I can get a commutation and try to go home sooner. I'm making a lot of changes in my life today.
I go, and it is done. The bell invites me. Hear it not, Duncan, for it is a knell that summons thee to heaven or to hell.
My name is Sarah, and I am Macbeth. Macbeth is a character that starts out as this good guy, and he kind of just loses himself along the way, I think, and he becomes this person that you don't even recognize in the end. It kind of mimics a person that's, you know, a felon. I feel a lot of people are inherently good, and something happens in their life or something influences them, and they make bad choices, and sometimes those choices are horrible, and it's hard to turn back from, and then you end up here. I've been at Huron since 2015, and God willing, I will get my parole next year in 2019.
But wherefore can I pronounce amen? I had most need of a blessing, and amen stuck in my throat.
I think that it teaches people to work together. It teaches people to not look at, you know, somebody else for their faults. It teaches us to look at, you know, what's good about a person. You know, we are not defined by our worst mistake. I just love this program. I love to perform. It really feels like I'm doing something that's positive and something that does not even remind me of prison.
This castle hath a pleasant sea. The air, nimbly and sweetly, recommends itself unto our gentle senses.
What do you think about the program?
I think it's a great program. It certainly serves to augment the other services that we have and reinforces their creativity, which ultimately lends to them having a successful transition. Sean Brewer, I am the warden.
But all's too weak for brave Macbeth. With his brandished steel, with his brandished steel.
My name is Julia. I play two doctors and a captain, a wounded captain.
Execution. Till he faced the slave, which ne'er shook hands nor bade farewell to him, till he unseamed him from the nave to the chops and posted his head upon a pike.
I have been here for a little less than 5 years, and I am supposed to be going home in December. I've grown up reading Shakespeare, so it's really cool to see it come to life. And originally, I didn't want a role at all. I wanted to help Franny direct, and then they kind of threw me into it. So I've actually been having a lot of fun memorizing. I wanted to be an actress as a kid, and it's been a lot of fun to kind of see what it's like to actually get into a role.
No sooner justice had, with valor armed, compelled these skipping kerns to trust their heels. But the Norwegian lord, surveying vantage, with furbished arms and new supplies of man, began a fresh assault.
Dismayed not this our captains, Macbeth and Banquo?
Yes.
I would say that Shakespeare in Prison is such a good way for us to connect with feeling like we are still part of the world and feeling like we can still contribute to the world. You don't have to be good at acting. You don't have to be good at reading. You don't have to be good at memorizing lines. You don't have to be good at anything but being yourself. And I love that Shakespeare in Prison specifically is so open to that.
Hail King Scotland!
Hail King of Scotland!
You can see photos of the dress rehearsal and find out more about Shakespeare in Prison. Just go to our website, michiganradio.org. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. We read a lot about what's going on in downtown Detroit. Stores and restaurants opening. It's becoming much more vibrant. But a lot of people are being left behind. They're not getting the opportunity to share in that prosperity. There's an organization working to change that. Build Institute is working to provide resources and support for small business development for primarily women and people of color. Joining us now are April Boyle. She's the founder and executive director of Build Institute, and April Anderson, who's on the board of directors, as well as the chef and owner of Good Cakes and Bakes. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. Welcome.
So, April Boyle, I first want you to explain a couple of terms for me, a couple of phrases. You use the term equitable entrepreneurship and inclusive entrepreneurship. What do they mean?
That means that we want to make sure that entrepreneurship and small business ownership is welcoming and open to anybody who has an idea and wants to work hard and create a business. And so that can look like anything from people of color, women, LGBTQ, people with disabilities, immigrants, youth, folks who don't fit into that typical kind of vision we have of a tech entrepreneur, or the vision that comes to mind when we think of entrepreneurship.
April Anderson, I understand not only on the board of directors now, but you're a graduate of one of the Build Institute's programs. What did that do for you? How did that help you?
So being a part of the Build Institute helped me. It helped me really define what Good Cakes and Bakes was going to be. It helped me to narrow down and to be able to vocalize what our niche was, what made us a different bakery. So in my head, I knew what we were, but going through Bill helped me to understand and be able to vocalize what that was.
And it seems you've had some real success baking for Oprah Winfrey. That's pretty good. You got chosen by the James Beard Foundation for the Chef's Bootcamp for Policy and Change. Tell us a little bit about Good Cakes and Bakes and why it was a good fit with the Build Institute's class of graduates.
So Good Cakes and Bakes is an organic, all-natural bakery located in the city of Detroit. And it was a great fit for us because it allowed us to not only to get our numbers, get us focused on what we wanted to be, what Good Cakes and Bakes was going to stand for, but it also allowed us the connection and the resources that Bill has. So once you graduate from Bill, it's not like you graduate and you just go out on your own. You still have that connection. You have a whole group of people who are either graduates or current Bill Institute cohort, and so you get the resources of them. You get to be able to have people that you can like bounce ideas off of. It's just such a wonderful, wonderful organization outside of the classroom. So once you leave the classroom, you still have this great family that you can count on.
Build Institute's now helped a number of budding entrepreneurs. April Boyle, what kind of impact are you having in Southeast Michigan?
We're having great impact. We have graduated over 1,400 folks from our various programs with about 500 active companies and almost 1,000 jobs being created. We know that talent is universal, and there's so much talent that exists in our neighborhoods and in our communities. We just need to find a way to activate that talent and provide resources and opportunity for folks. And once we do that, the businesses and the ideas and the projects that exist out there come to fruition. So we're seeing commercial corridors like where April Anderson is on Livernois, the Avenue of Fashion. It is looking so vibrant, and more people, it's becoming more attractive for people to live there. April can speak to this. She also is a facilitator for us and teaches classes in her place of business, which is actually kind of functioning not only as a bakery, but a little community center and kind of a small business incubator in its own right. And it's inspiring for the neighbors to see her being successful because she looks like them. And then they're like, I've always wanted to start a business. How did you do it? How can I do it?
So here's the big question, and that is, where has society failed that an institution like Build Institute is even necessary?
I don't want to depress you with the statistics of the city of Detroit, but...
Well, go ahead. I think most of us are familiar with them, but yeah. Poverty's a real problem.
It's a real problem.
Bank loans a real problem.
Right. We've experienced the largest municipal bankruptcy in the country. We're a majority minority city with all of the challenges associated with that. You know, people who have been cut out of the economic system. So we have to right side that. We've had 50 years of disinvestment. We need 50 years of overinvestment in our neighborhoods and in our communities. And I wouldn't even call it overinvestment. I would call it due appropriate investment.
Right.
You know, we throw millions of dollars at technology companies and millions of dollars in subsidies going to Amazons and big corporate billionaires to create projects. Why aren't we doing that same thing for the little guy and the small business?
I know that the neighborhoods that I have covered have always told me everything's happening in downtown and not much else. Lately, Mayor Duggan has instituted some neighborhood things. Livernois is one of the targeted areas. Is that enough, or are we still going to need a place like Build Institute to really do the on-the-ground work.
Oh, you're definitely going to continue to build because you need people with boots on the ground that's doing the work. So you have all these wonderful programs that's coming and happening in City Detroit, but if no one is getting out to the neighborhoods telling the business owners about it, there's no benefit to it because most small business owners, they work, live in their business. So they don't have the opportunity to go downtown when these events are happening to find out the resources. So they need someone on the ground to bring that information to them. And that's what Build does. Because Build is offering the classes inside of the neighborhoods, that means the resources are being taken to those neighborhoods. So people are getting the information. They probably wouldn't get the information if it wasn't for a Build class being hosted in their neighborhood. So a lot of the resources that's coming to the city, without Build, people in the neighborhoods wouldn't know about it.
Let's talk about some other things you're doing. I'm a big fan of Instagram. Recently, I've been seeing a lot of photos of Build Bazaar. tell me what that is and what it's for.
So part of our work at Build Institute is to give people opportunities to have proof of concept, right? They have a great product or service. They've been through an 8-week business and project planning class. Now we need to encourage them to spread their wings and fly. So one of the programs that we offer is Build Bazaar, which is a pop-up marketplace. We're doing a great project this summer in partnership with Detroit Riverfront Conservancy at the DeQuinder Cut, so the Detroit Freight Yard Project.
Let me stop you just for a second, because we have a lot of listeners outside the Detroit area. Tell us what the DeQuinder Cut is.
The DeQuinder Cut is a former railway that has been turned into a hiking trail. And it connects the riverfront and Eastern Market. There's food and drinks. There are art installations. There's some entertainment that happens down there. And now a marketplace.
So who's going to be at this bazaar?
We have amazing vendors, including jewelry makers. We have soaps and beauty products. We have T-shirts and clothing, food and beverage. All kinds of fun stuff.
So how long do these entrepreneurs get to be in this space, this pop-up space?
All summer long. So Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. The bazaar happens from 11 to 3, but there's other programming that takes place. I think the food and beverage is open in the evenings as well. There are some art installations, some entertainment. We're also doing a Build Bazaar Concert of Colors, and then also part of the Henry Ford Maker Fair.
And you're establishing your center. You're building out some room and a space in Corktown as well.
Yes, we are. So we've been partnering and subleasing with another nonprofit organization that we're outgrowing the space, and we're moving our headquarters into the corner at Michigan and Trumbull in Corktown. I'm sure you've heard all the rumblings about Ford and Corktown and Michigan Avenue that they may be turning this into a mobility innovation center. And so we are going to hold space for inclusive innovation, meaning our entrepreneurs are grassroots, community-based entrepreneurs who are opening the bricks and mortar service and lifestyle companies that the talent that Ford wants to attract want to see in their neighborhoods. And so we're going to have a space where these entrepreneurs are getting trained. They're getting able to practice and experiment so that they can go out and be prepared to compete with, frankly, some of the corporates that are finding Detroit more attractive.
I also read you put together something called Detroit Soup. Its goal is to put together micro grants. How does that work?
Yeah, so Detroit Soup is a great organization and program that's been happening in Detroit for almost 10 years. So we're really trying to say to Detroiters, we don't have to depend on government. We don't have to depend on the big corporates and the banks to make the change that we want to make. We can, as individual citizens, put $5 towards a project that we want to see in our neighborhood or $25 through a Kiva loan. We need to start voting with our own dollars and investing in the types of businesses and business owners we want to see in our neighborhoods.
So this sounds like, to me, except you don't have corporate execs, but you have just normal people coming in a Shark Tank situation,
yes. Mm-hmm.
And but you feed them as well.
We feed them. It's a party. It's a celebration. It's low pressure and low stress. There's lots of connections that are made. All kinds of different people come. It's about getting the word out about your project or business. And yeah, it's a really fun event.
It's basically soup, bread, and salad. And I have a suggestion. I think maybe it's a goodie from Good Cakes and Bakes.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes April does provide us some goodies.
Let's look at the future now. When you think about Build Institute's future, what does success and your goals look like?
April, what do you think?
Oh, when I think about build and I also think about success, I just feel like as long as it's inclusive and continue to work with the neighborhoods and making sure that they're intentionally reaching out to the neighborhoods, it's going to be successful. It's going to be successful. It's going to continue to be successful as long as build continue to do the things they're doing, which is they're intentionally inclusive, intentionally going out into the neighborhoods, intentionally marketing and targeting the disenfranchised, people with barriers that wouldn't be able to maybe start a business without this information that Build is bringing to them.
April Lessward.
Yeah, our mission, vision, our goal is to make Detroit the global leader in inclusive entrepreneurship. We have an opportunity to do that right now. We also have an opportunity to go the other way. And it's my hope that we will decide to make Detroit that place that is small business friendly, where everyone can participate and be economically mobile.
April Boyle and April Anderson are with Build Institute, working to help women and people of color overcome the barriers to small business ownership. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Still to come on the program, we'll talk with Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly as we continue checking in with the 2018 candidates for governor. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. We've been talking to candidates running for governor this year, and today we talk with Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly, who's running for the Republican nomination. Welcome to Stateside.
Thanks, Lester. Great to be on the show with you.
We've been asking all the candidates a short list of important issues, so let's start with education. Average student test scores keep going down in Michigan. We're losing ground. What's the solution to that problem?
This is literally my top priority. If you want to have a good outcome, you have to have a good beginning. And so I would start with the pre-K part of it, making sure that kids are starting school ready to learn. We have a lot of programs. We need more of a system where they're working together, particularly for kids that are growing up in poverty. But then it's all hands on deck for reading. And it's more than just reading coaches. Reading coaches are an important part of it, but we have to ensure that every single kid learns to read, whether they have dyslexia or another type of learning disability, or whether they're just behind on phonics or vocabulary, or they need a motivational reading coach. We have to be able to do that right in order to get the rest of it down the road in terms of the rest of the education system. And then it's bringing back skilled trades and hands-on learning and getting away from this one-size-fits-all approach and recognizing there are a lot of different pathways to being successful. And the more that we can put that, our parents and our kids, the information in their hands about where opportunity is, the better outcomes we're going to have.
So the things you were talking about as far as helping kids learn to read, it sounds like that's going to be expensive. How do you pay for that?
Well, I don't think it has to be all that expensive. I think where we make the investment is in our teachers. Our teachers, they need the type of support in gaining the latest and greatest in research and best practices in their classrooms. And I look at the other states that have really excelled in this area, whether the ones that have done well for a long time, like Massachusetts or Minnesota, or the ones that have really risen in recent years, like Tennessee, what you find is that they really put a lot into development of teachers, ongoing professional development of teachers. So whether it's behavior management in classes or identifying what the real problem is that is holding a child back and equipping them with the tools that they need in order to get the best outcomes for those students, regardless of whatever challenges they bring to the classroom with them. And so I think really this is the best thing that we can do is to take a page from Tennessee's book and really really focus on helping our teachers to develop all the different best practices in terms of getting the highest and best potential out of their kids.
Despite an increase in the gasoline tax and higher registration fees, which you know, people grumbled about. But they're still angry about the roads in Michigan. Governor Snyder says there should have been more money for repair and to improve transportation infrastructure. What's your take?
Well, we are in the middle of passing or implementing a road funding package that was passed just a few years ago. And this will be the first year that there's really substantial increased funding for our roads because of that. It'll work its way up to $1.2 billion. We're also putting additional general fund resources into our roads as the economy grows faster than expected. And then beyond that, we're paying off the debt. You know, the previous administration left us with $2.3 billion in debt. So every single year, the transportation fund has to make hundreds of millions of dollars in loan payments. We no longer borrow money. We're paying off that debt. When the rest of it is retired, that'll be another boost to the annual funding. And then beyond that, it's about raising the standards, about getting better when we're replacing these roads, doing it in a way that the roads last longer and being more efficient with it and expecting everybody who shares the right-of-way of the road to coordinate their repair, maintenance, and replacement schedules so you don't fix the road and then tear it up next year for a sewer line and then tear it up a few years later for a cable or something like that. It's the idea of all that being coordinated so you share the expenses, bring down the costs at the same time that we're investing more in our roads.
The debate on guns is always at the top of hot political issues. What's the best approach to stop mass shootings at schools and other places?
The most logical place to start is with security in our schools. There are, if you think about the type of security that exists in buildings where you have precious people and things inside, why wouldn't we do those things at our schools? So hardening of the schools is a logical first step. The budget that is in the works right now has very significant resources to help schools cover the cost of not just secure entry, but it includes secure entry. It's also campus-wide monitoring and fail-safe communication systems and even things like having the resource officers on hand. And we also need to help our schools with guidance counselors and those who can identify problems before they become a crisis, good proactive measures that we can take in order to prevent this. We know that in our state where we have a system for people to report and all of those tips are followed up on, that it has made a difference. It has saved lives, particularly with suicide, but I think also with potential violence, that we just need to stay really focused on this and doing everything that we can do to prevent a crisis from happening in the first place.
Healthcare, the possible end of Obamacare. We've got work for Medicaid in Michigan. What would you do as governor to make affordable healthcare insurance available to the greatest number of Michigan citizens?
We've made a lot of progress here in our state, but there's a really great opportunity in front of us right now with this strong economy. We are up 540,000 new jobs in our state. We had a 17-year low in unemployment, and we're the number six fastest income growth state in the nation as well. I mean, all of these things are really great demand drivers in our state, and it's created a huge demand for people. The biggest challenge that we are faced with today in terms of economic growth is not enough people to fill all these jobs that are being created. At the same time, there are people that need opportunity. The most important thing that we can do in order to help people get more independent lives and better health insurance coverage is to get them a great job or get them prepared to take one of these great jobs that have been created. And so that should be the focus. When we come to the social service reform, it's connecting people with the skills they need to go out there and compete and win in a 21st century global economy and not need so much help from the state in the first place.
We're talking to Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly, who is running for governor in Michigan. Water contamination issues are being revealed across the state. What can Michigan do about better safeguarding our water?
One of the things that our state can be proud of is how proactive we are being, particularly compared to other states around the nation, with PFAS, this contamination that has shown up in a few places around our state. This is absolutely a nationwide problem. You only see a couple of states, maybe two or three states, that are being as proactive as Michigan and literally setting the standards on this. And so it's standing up the laboratories, understanding where this type of contamination has occurred over the last 50 or even 100 years, and then really building the science around it in the first place. I can't say enough about being proactive. Here in Michigan, we have a special responsibility. We are stewards of the largest deposit of surface fresh water you'll find anywhere in the world, and with that comes a great responsibility. And being proactive and setting that standard, being good stewards, it's a responsibility that we have bigger than anyone else.
During the campaign, you stressed that you spent a lot of time in Flint in the aftermath of the lead contamination issue. Many Flint residents still don't have confidence in the safety of the water. The state urges residents to use filters. Given that, why did the Snyder administration stop delivering bottled water to Flint?
Now that it's been almost 2 years that the Flint water system has met the same standards that every other water system in the state has to meet, it was time. It was always going to be controversial when you stop. The idea of bottled water was something that people felt more comfortable with. But the Flint water system is the most tested water system in the history of the United States of America by far. Nobody's even close. And so the level of and the degree of confidence in exactly what the condition of that water system is far beyond most other places. I don't blame somebody for not having confidence in it, but it is independently validated. It has been almost 2 years now that the water system has met the same standards, and so it was time to make that transition. When it comes to the recommendation for filters, it's just a matter of when there's construction happening in your neighborhood. It doesn't matter whether you're in Grand Rapids or Detroit or Jackson or Traverse City or Alpena or Flint. If there's construction in your neighborhood and you're on a public water system, you ought to use a filter. That's just a good practice for anybody that is on a public system where there's a lot of vibration and construction happening in your area. But I want to stress that Flint is meeting the same water quality standards that everybody else has to meet and has been for almost 2 years.
One of your Republican opponents, Bill Schuette, mentions at every opportunity that he has the endorsement of President Donald Trump. All of the Republican candidates, including you, have stressed how closely their policy and beliefs align with President Trump. We recently heard from former U.S. Speaker of the House John Boehner say while he was in Michigan that there is no Republican Party. There's a Trump Party. The Republican Party is off somewhere taking a nap. I wonder what you think of that.
Well, I don't agree with that characterization. I'm around the highways and the byways of Michigan a lot more than former Speaker Boehner is. And the bottom line is our people are focused on good schools for their kids and opportunity and job growth and income growth and the ability to chase their hopes and dreams and aspirations in this state. They want their auto insurance rates lowered and their roads fixed. So I don't think that it's a matter of these are matters of political parties as much as they're issues that people want results on. And the candidates that come forward with realistic plans, like real plans, not just bullet points or talking points, those are the candidates that are going to do well with the voters. And so whenever I know these questions and people tend to focus and talk a lot about endorsements, I have the endorsement of Governor Snyder, for example. But at the end of the day, I think that people are going to make their decision based on the policy proposals of the individuals, not based on endorsements. Endorsements are not plans.
You and Governor Rick Snyder have worked very closely. He brought you in on a lot of things, including helping out with the budget. I'm just wondering, after working with him so closely for nearly 8 years, if you're elected governor, how would you lead differently than Rick Snyder?
Well, it's a matter of emphasis on what we need from this point forward. In the beginning, there was a need for a total restructuring. Our state was at the bottom of every single list you'd want to be at the top of. We're at the top of every list you'd rather be at the bottom of. But moving forward, as we've seen all these new jobs created, our biggest challenge here for economic growth is we need more people that are prepared to take all these jobs that are being created. And so the emphasis now is on investment in our people. And that's what I'm so excited about. I'm very much a people person anyway. I love being with people and around people. I mean, that part of this work and this job is the most rewarding part. And we built a strong foundation. That what goes on top of that foundation, it's just all about people development. And by the way, it's not just our general institutions like our education system, but I don't want anybody to get left behind. I mean, spend a lot of public policy development time on disability employment and helping people from addiction that have addiction issues recover and treating mental illness. And even when a person is getting out of prison and it's time for them to get their life back on track, how do we help them do that? That's what I'm really excited about in this demand that is, that exists for people today, is creating opportunities for those that have been left out in the past.
As part of the Snyder administration, what, if anything, do you wish would have been done differently?
Well, you can look back on any administration and see some areas where, with hindsight, things could have been different. And there are certainly many examples of that. One though, I'll hold out there is that I think that when it comes to no-fault auto insurance reform, that the problem has been this all-or-nothing approach that has been taken. Our people need relief from rights, but we shouldn't be talking about sacrificing good coverage. We have a world-class traumatic brain injury healthcare system in our state, and we should not put that at jeopardy. So rather than taking an all-or-nothing approach where you have 6 or 7 or 8 major reform stuff into one bill, I think a better approach would be to take these changes one at a time. Start with a fraud authority, give it teeth, staff it up, make it a real deterrent. That will make a bigger difference in the areas that have the highest rates. And then we need to have a requirement for both timely payment and a rate schedule for what gets billed to our catastrophic claims fund. I mean, there's in some cases there are reports that the bills being submitted there are too high. In other cases, it's that payment takes 3 years to get, and so it makes this whole system inefficient and expensive. And if you want to keep the cost down, I think it really makes sense to open it up to more transparency, to really know exactly what the cost drivers are that are leading to these higher car insurance assessments. And if we can just get those three things done, take them all standalone, one at a time, move them through the system, we'll get some momentum behind reform, get those rates down, and get people some success in working together. I mean, these different sides of this issue have been so polarized for so many years that we need a game changer. And I think the game changer is a totally different approach to reform.
Well, I guess the question really was, what would you wish you would have done differently, considering that the Snyder administration during its tenure had false unemployment fraud accusations, had the Flint water debacle, had controversy with emergency managers. None of that is something that you would want to reconsider?
Well, you asked me for one example, and I gave you one example, and I said there were many. I could give you a few more, too. There's some lessons learned that, for example, in Flint, when I talked to public officials, there are a couple lessons learned. First is that when a person says they have a problem, even if the experts disagree, right, like in the case of Flint, where people said, you know, we have this problem, and then the experts within the bureaucracy said, yeah, but, you know, we've got these tests and it looks okay. It's important that you continue to push past the jargon and the technical compliance speak and get right down to plain language. And bureaucracies and government are so good at giving compliance speech. That's something that we, as public officials, that mostly are people from other walks of life that come into these situations, getting past that is really important. So it's not accepting technical speak for an answer, but instead forcing plain language answers. I'll give an example of that would be, the question, somebody says, I've got a problem with the water, I don't trust it, and so the question is asked, is it safe? And a person in the bureaucracy says, well, the water testing according to the most recent samples falls within the federal lead and copper rule of 15 parts per billion. Well, it kind of sounds like they said yes, but they didn't really say yes. I mean, there's other questions like, is that standard the right standard in the first place? What do the trends look like? How confident are we that the samples are representative of the entire system? I mean, there are all kinds of additional questions to force the bureaucracy to get real about the situation instead of just leaving a compliance speak type of an answer. And that's a lesson that I hope that every single public official across our country really takes to heart.
Brian Kelly is running for the Republican nomination to be candidate for governor. He is currently lieutenant governor of the state of Michigan. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Lester. Great to be on the show with you again.
Okay, nothing says Michigan summer like a trip to the Great Lakes, right? Well, unfortunately, we cannot broadcast stateside from a pontoon boat, so we've got the next best thing. Send us your question about the Great Lakes, whether it's about the culture, economy, environment, or anything else you want to know about the Great Lakes. Go to michiganradio.org or leave us your question in a voicemail. You can call 734-764-7840. That's 734-764-7840, and you just might hear your answer on Stateside. Today, Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, and April Van Buren. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.